Leading a foundation with the largest network of civically engaged Latino philanthropists, social justice warrior Jacqueline Martinez Garzel is a force. On a mission to unleash the power of Latinos, the Latino Community Foundation seeks to radically change the concept, purpose, and pathway to philanthropy by returning to its core roots, love. At a critical moment in our nation's history, the rising groups of Latino leaders are fighting the battles of racism and classism that are raging in our country by honing in on the healing and redemptive power of love. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And I really tried to go slowly with that introduction and focus on the word love, because don't we all need to be talking about love more as a country? So for this next hour, our guests will share with us how the work of the Latino Community Foundation, an organization that is driven by change, not charity, is radicalizing the power of dynamics that have crept into the field of philanthropy and have held the sector captive in an oppressive and counterintuitive style. The ultimate objective for Jacqueline Martinez Garcel and her passionate team is to liberate capital and invest in grassroots movements and leaders that will drive us closer to a more just and representative democracy. And I'll tell you, folks, no surprise, I'm all in. Now, please join me in welcoming our guest, Jacqueline Martinez Garcel, the CEO of the Latino Community Foundation. Welcome, Jacqueline. Our team has been looking forward to this time. Three of us were at Bioneers in San Rafael in October of last year, and we almost stood up and created a ruckus with a few of the things you said. So we're happy to have you at what is really a critical time in our nation's history.
Well, first of all, Gina, thank you for such a beautiful introduction. You've captured the essence of the work that we're doing here so eloquently. I'm proud to be having this moment with you to talk about the Latino Community Foundation and the work that we're building here in California, which I hope will serve as a model for the rest of the nation.
Yeah, you and me both, kiddo. I'm telling you, the work you're doing is about as important as any I read about. You literally want to unleash the power of Latinos in California through the work of LCF. Can you share with us not just what that means and look like, but why is it so important now, perhaps more than ever in our nation's history? What is the work you're doing, and why does it matter so much?
So, Gina, that's in fact our mission statement. We exist to unleash the power of Latinos. And, you know, I came to California 3 years ago from New York to lead this foundation. I had no idea the direction our country was going to take. I kind of had a feeling, given the fact that, you know, we had our first Black president, and you can almost sense some of the racial tension just kind of surfacing to the top. Things that have been here for generations that we just as a country have not healed from yet. And so when I came here, the vision and the mission of this organization was to really lift up the Latino community in California, which, by the way, makes up 39% of the population. And the reason that was important was because the values that ground Latinos as they've helped build this country, as they've helped pour their lives and souls into the soil of this country, as I like to say, matters right now, right? Those values that our families have taught us to come here and give and pay forward and invest in family and in community is so critical. And why not invest in this population that came with a vision and a purpose, and by the way, who's always been here in a very community, family-centric way to try and build a nation that really is about others, right? That is not just about a me-centered approach, but really about the community that we're trying to build to lift each other up. And so the opportunity really, this was in October 2015, the foundation had been around for about a little eight to 10 years as part of the San Francisco Foundation. They were investing in Latino-led groups, but there was an opportunity to just really build a platform for Latinos in California to own their voice and unleash that power that's driven by love, by a value of love and family and hard work and justice, right? And so the country started to take a turn in 2016. That campaign was probably one of the most racially divided that I've seen in the last decades in our country. And for us, it was important that we hold hold our ground and hold our values to the core and stand firm on those things and not be pushed into that backbone of hate and divisiveness, but really hone in on what brings us together as a community and as a country.
So for our listeners, do you know why we were so excited about having Jacqueline on the show with answers like that? It's like, let's press pause and reflect on what you just shared. And even though I want to kind of end on the amazing accomplishments, because what you can't measure, you cannot change, and you measure, so we'll talk about the impact report. But I also want to talk about you're having an impact, and that's what matters. You're not just saying it, and you are increasing the number of philanthropists. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about some of the impact in the recent months. I mean, you're engaging, you're coming at it from any number of angles. It's not just mm-hmm. about unleashing. We're going to talk about foundations and how much money they sit on. Mm-hmm. That's when mm-hmm. Meredith and Kelly and I wanted to stand up and cheer and go, yes, yes, they have billions, and it's just sitting in a bank.
And it's the public's money, by the way. It's not tax dollars. That's right.
Oh, anyway, so we're a little radical on that, so I'm going to try and control myself. But talk about some of the things that you're doing with your movement, because it's a movement. Sure. You're not just an organization, you're a movement.
That's right. I love how you really did capture the heart of who we are, Gina. And in the last couple of years, last 3 years, we have built the largest network of Latino philanthropists in the country. And it really is about unleashing that economic power back into the community, right? So when you ask me, well, what does power mean for us? It's really about civic, economic power, right? Driven by a sense of love and paying it forward. And one of the core pillars of this organization is building this movement of Latino philanthropists. And by the way, our movement includes non-Latinos as well. The reason we're saying Latino philanthropists is that it is a majority of Latinos, but it is folks that are driven by a sense of changing the narrative of who Latinos have been looked upon and talked about. So Latinos have been can't repeat this point enough, have been in this country for generations. And in fact, if we retrace history, we're here in California, for example, way before we drew the lines. And so this idea of honing in back at the values, right? When Latinos give back, they give back with a sense of wanting to build community. And building this movement means that we are not trying to sit on capital, but that we're trying to give this capital back to the nonprofit sector that's out there organizing our communities, that's out there building youth leadership, that's out there fighting for justice and demanding justice on behalf of immigrant communities writ large, right? Not just for Latinos. But the idea is that for too long, we have built a model of philanthropy where it really is about that minimum 5% that foundations give back. And that, you know, kind of giving a tax write-off for very wealthy people to, one, feel good about themselves and also to get some money back in terms of their own capital they have. But we're trying to change that model. If philanthropy is really going to drive change, then we need to get the money into the hands of the people that are driving that change and then create partnerships between those philanthropists and those change makers, right? So when our Latino Giving Circle network, now again, like I said, the largest in the country, get together to discuss what they want to fund, to meet the organizations that they're going to fund. This isn't just being done, you know, via paper and a check is written. We bring the nonprofits and together with these Giving Circle members, they decide together how they're going to invest this money. And it's not just about one program here and there. It's about investing in the mission and vision of these change makers on the ground, on the front lines of driving that social change. And in California, those nonprofits right now are really trying to change not, I want to say change, try not to hold the line is what I'm thinking of right now is, you know, these are organizations that have for years worked in communities trying to bring equity in terms of economic class, to bring equity in terms of education, to bring equity in terms of jobs. And at the same time, we're living in a political context that's robbing people of the sense of dignity and humanity right now just to survive. And so we're trying to invest as much as we can in these last couple of months. So these organizations feel both connected to a larger purpose and supported by a larger network, but also have the resources that they need. And when we give grants, we like to say core support grants. It's not about give us, you know, a written report on every single thing that you're doing. No, we believe in the mission of these organizations and we're investing in them. And that's one pillar. The second movement that we're trying to change and radicalize is how we invest in nonprofits, period. We're in Northern California, the tech hub of the world.
Right.
We are the fifth largest economy in the world.
Billions
of dollars. You go to a neighborhood in Palo Alto and you have not the 1%, the 0.1% of folks. And so why can't we rethink how we're investing in this sector that's really the one that's holding our communities together? And we launched what we call the Nonprofit Accelerator, Latino Nonprofit Accelerator, to begin to change how we think of these leaders and then give them the tools that they need to be able to be seen as startups. Like, you know, we value so much the startup company that's creating the latest app to feed our cats at home. But the reality is that there are people trying to change the world on the ground, strapped for resources. And why can't we move that money to those hands and those hearts to be able to make that change? And then the third pillar of our organization is our advocacy platform. So we are committed to not just support, but to be that voice and to stand up and be bold, whether it's in Sacramento or in Washington, D.C., to set an agenda that's equitable for Latinos here in California, to ensure that when the state budget gets released, that it's mindful of the fact that 15 million Latinos have helped build this economy, but have yet to be included in the growth of the economy. And so you look at the Central Valley, for example, where this is the breadbasket of our country. The Central Valley is where more than 70% of our agriculture comes out of, where our food, every table in America gets fed with products that are grown in the Central Valley. Our farm workers there are still getting paid beneath minimum wage. How is that okay? How is that okay that they're living beneath standards of living that we wouldn't accept in any other country, but we accept them here? And we need to change that. And so whether it's organizing for voting, which has been kind of our focal point these last 2 years, also creating and investing in a pipeline of leaders that would be ready to be on a water board or a school board or a city council, that have progressive ideas that reflect the electorate of our state. And from both sides, right? We're a nonpartisan organization. We just want thoughtful, progressive leaders that represent the values of the communities that they serve. And the census is another critical element of our advocacy work. In just a year, in a couple of months, we will have one of the most decided census for our country. One of the reasons that we are seeing these hateful groups kind of grow, even in here in California, is in part that we're seeing a seismic demographic change in our country. And by the way, in 2020, when that census comes out, and if we do it accurately and fairly, we will see even a greater change in how our country, the face of our country, is changing. And we should be ready and welcoming that and embracing those changes as a whole.
So sometimes when I do these shows, and I have done hundreds of them in the past 10 years, I get hit with the thought there are guests that I should just introduce and say, hi, everybody, it's Jacqueline Martinez Garzel, and she has the next hour. And I mean that. It's a high compliment because people like you are out there on the forefront of fighting for the very country that I was born in, that I believe in, and that all of us should be aware that democracy is at stake, and what you're doing is incredible. So some of the questions I had, you responded to already, but I want to dig a little bit deeper into some of them, because, you know, what's at stake on your website, it says our economy, our democracy, our future. What are some of the challenges that you're finding out there to making your work happen? Is there resistance? Is there fear around voting? What are your constituents or your tribe? What are they telling you?
So for one, I think folks are feeling just really stretched at this point, right?
Right.
So we're going into now 2 years of just consistent attacks on communities of immigrants that, you know, yes, I don't like the word fear, right? Because I think that our communities, just by showing up, you saw the numbers in the midterm elections,
right.
We have historic
right.
turnouts. So like the heart and the will is there to just keep fighting for the soul of our democracy and to show up when it matters most is there. One thing that I get frustrated about is when I hear newspapers talking about, well, the sleeping giant, as they talk about Latino voters, will they finally wake up? And I keep saying they've been awoke. They've just been working this whole time.
Right.
And we've made
right.
it difficult for them, in fact, to vote in certain circumstances, right? So when I think about the possibilities of what we can change at this moment, like you said, we're at a critical moment in our nation's history, but we can turn it for good, right? And so, for example, things like having a national voter day that's a holiday would make it easier for our people just to show up and vote, right? So there are things that are emerging now in this moment of change that would ease the burden on people who want to see our country thrive, who want to see us return to fundamental values that we all came and voted for and wanted to be a part of, right? And so there is that sense of being a little exhausted, but willing to go that extra mile, right, for however long we need to go. As far as the other concerns, is this constant narrative, too, of Latinos, I don't want to say constant, but, you know, I think that in journalism, folks are finally understanding that we need more representation there to be able to value a different narrative, right? So when you hear someone as respected as Tom Brokaw, who I love and grew up watching, right, to say that, well, people need to assimilate more and speak the language, well, the majority of Latinos do. And by the way, the majority of 18-year-olds in this country have been born in the U.S., and are bilingual and are bicultural. And we need to be telling that story more and honoring the things and the sacrifices that have already been made, as opposed to always looking at it from the angle of deficit, right? What are Latinos not doing? No, we have done a lot. We have contributed to our economy. We have contributed to our democracy. Are we voting below what we should be voting? Yes. Have we made it difficult for some communities to vote? Yes. And let's acknowledge that and start from that point. So our goal here at the Latino Community Foundation is to ensure that young people, specifically young people, in part because for Latinos, the median age is 27. Number two, over 60,000 Latinos become eligible to vote every single year. So the numbers are increasing at a very rapid pace. And so why not make sure that these young people, who, by the way, have been robbed of an education in civics, you know, most of us might have had a great history teacher that taught us the importance of democracy, of civics, of the census, of voting. But so many of our public school system don't have the resources to be able to teach that fundamental element of who we are as a country, right? So at a minimum, we want to ensure that 18-year-olds are feeling engaged, informed, and valued. It's one of the reasons why at the beginning of last year in January, we hosted a forum, a gubernatorial forum, to bring all six candidates that were running for governor. And it was the first time it had been done in California, where we said we want a forum to focus on Latino youth, to focus on Latino issues. And we filled up a room of more than 1,200 in that room, and over a million people watched it on national TV, where we had the candidates talk about, what about higher education for Latinos? Where, by the way, again, if we were just to close that gap, we would have enough people graduating from college to fill that workforce gap that we'll have by 2025, right? So Latinos in California said make up 39% of the population. We're only graduating Latinos at 11%. And it's not because young people don't desire that graduate. They're in fact graduating from high school at a faster rate and at a higher rate than in the past 25 years. They're entering colleges now more than double than they were 25 years ago, but they're not graduating. And when we start asking some of those questions, it's in part because of the culture in some of our universities, what we value, and the fact that our young people sometimes have more work experience than others because they've had to support their families. Well, why are we not valuing that as part of our educational system? And so there's a lot of things institutional and policies that we need to rethink in order to take the burden off of Latinos to just, like, we expect them to just rise up. Well, there's been a lot of things holding us down that we need to think of that are more at the policy, the systemic level.
And they are really and truly things that have to be looked at. We have to go a little bit deeper. Insidious. They've been institutionalized. And people like me who care deeply about these issues, I'm on a constant learning curve because guess what, folks? I was born with white privilege and I understand what that means. I haven't a clue what it's like to have any of these things that are being talked about in all of these organizations like yours and anything with Black Lives Matter. White people, and I'm not afraid to talk about that at all, we have the responsibility to take a deeper cut and acknowledge that these practices have been, they're institutionalized, and we have to expose them and then be a part of a strong voice for change. And it's what excites me about what's going on now. And I just want to share with you a conversation that we had with our family, because believe me, we have a lot of conversations. And one of the things that impresses the heck out of me about LCF is you are not making it political. And it's not. We can't do it. It's not political. It's about the power of Latinos. And we need strong Latinos who are Republicans and strong Latinos who are Democrats. We need to go about it as the country. And what I feel that you scream and that your website screams is, let's look at these issues and let's see how we can change them. There's no shame, blame, guilt. It's all about hope and possibility and change. And we better. So the family was talking about Donald Trump, and I don't think he is a political issue. He's not a Republican. Give me a break. I have worked side by side with Republicans my entire career, forward thinking, willing to come to the table, compromising.
Family focused.
Yes.
Yes.
Stellar
yes.
human yes. being. So he, like when I talk about him, I'm not trying to make it political, but if it wasn't for him, do you think we would have had 100 women and minorities like never before win in 2018? And when you talk about staying awake, my daughter tells me that one of the expressions is stay woke. We got to stay woke. And it's like, so you hit on that. And it's a perfect segue to something else I want to hit on and not forget to do. Your keynote at Bioneers, I want to read a quote from the description of your presentation so people can kind of get a sense for what you talked about. On a mission to unleash the power of Latinos, the Latino Community Foundation seeks to radically change the concept, purpose, and pathway to philanthropy by returning to its core roots, love. So talk to us about why you think we need to hone in on the healing and redemptive power of love as we are fighting this battle of racism and classism that is raging in our country. And if you don't think so, what rock are you sleeping under? We need to use the word love more. And you have the courage to do that. And I think any public speaker that has audiences that you command, it's not easy to talk about love. Excuse me, I'm not crying. I got my something caught in my throat. Excuse me. Why is it important that we talk more about love?
Yeah, Tina, that is, and it's funny, I'm in my office right now and I'm staring at three signs that just have love written around it. So it's a constant reminder also for us to just continue to ground ourselves in that. And before I even jump into that, you said something so powerful, right? It's not about politics. And what it is, what it really is about, it's about values.
Yes.
And love is one of those, right? So this is not about Republican or Democrat or this party or that party. It's really about this fundamental democracy that we have built, that it has yet to be perfected, right?
Yes.
It's still an experiment of 243 years, right? That we have yet to make perfect, but it's based on certain values that I think if we focus more on that, there'd be so much more unity in how we think about the solutions that we need. And, you know, you mentioned it, and in Latino communities, you can easily have a dinner table with four Republicans and four Democrats sit around the table and, you know, disagree on a lot of things. But when it comes to family and it comes to hard work and it comes to investing in others and creating opportunities, we can agree on those things. And it's in part because it's what we see this country representing, right? And on that note, on the love piece, well, it's a risk, like you said, to go out there and say that the fundamental piece that we will lead by is love. And I have to say, it's not new, right? We heard Martin Luther King talk about it over and over again in his speeches. And I am convinced that the reason that his movement lasted as long as he did was because he led with that. And in fact, that one video I showed at the end of Bioneer is that power without love and love without power is, they're both useless, right? We can fight for power, but what good is it for Latinos here in California or in any part of the country to gain power if they're going to lead from the same place that others have led by, right? What good is that for us as a foundation to say we want to build up movement of Latino philanthropists and not put love at the center of that, when in fact philanthropy has been missing that sense of compassion without the charitable idea, right? Just taking a step back and saying, you know, I will love my neighbor as myself and want to see the same opportunities that were given to me and my family for them. And I will fight so hard because I will invest the love in them as it's been invested in me. And the truth be told is that any one of us can look back in our lives and see how love was a transformational power in our lives. Now, whether it be from our family, a neighbor, a teacher, a nonprofit, there are moments in our lives that were defining, right? Where we saw, I can either give up now, right? Or someone came alongside me and lifted me up and invested in me that power of love and hope, which I said at the Bioneers go hand in hand, right? When someone is investing with, and love is a verb, it's a choice that we make. It's not a feeling. It is a choice that we are making. And it is one of the most powerful, not just emotions, but verbs that we can use to describe the work that we are doing. And that love mends, that love heals, that love invests, that love will continue with you when that moment comes and you're about to give up. That transformational love that someone can invest in you will push you forward. And what does that give to people? It gives a sense of hope that not everything is lost, right? So that other question you asked in your own reflections of, would we have had this change in leadership had it not been for Trump? I would dare to say probably not, in part because there's been and not just from the leadership, but also from the people who have supported, to lead with non-love, with hate. And this country is remembering that's not who we are. And so it's awakened people who always wanted to lead and to serve, because those legislators that are in office know that their number one job is a public servant, right? But to do it because hate was taking too much of a big platform, and the only way to push back on that is to lead with love. That's the reason why we're seeing so many women and so many women of color, because they're not afraid of that. It's not just that they're, you know, there's now a huge change in gender, but they're realizing that the values that we bring are just as important as the brain and the will to do the work, right? So the intellect is critical, but the heart is just as important. There's no reason why we can't lead with our hearts and our mind. In fact, I'll just share this with you, and I read this just yesterday. There are more neurons going in the direction from our heart to our brain than from our brain to our heart, which
Love
says
it.
A lot of how
Love
we've
it.
Been created,
yes.
right?
Yes.
There is so much more to be learned if we listen to the heart matters of the things that we deal with. And so, yes, unafraid and unabashedly say that we will lead with love, and understanding that love without power is also insignificant. And so we need to build that power, but put love at the center of it.
And I am all in on that one too. So I agree. We need love. We need to be talking about it more. Another point.
And be unafraid about it.
And be unafraid. Be proud of it.
Be
absolutely
proud
of it.
That's right. And not. It's not a soft thing, right?
No,
like we.
It is not weak. It is not weakness.
There's so much strength in it.
In the power of that.
That's right.
Totally agree.
That's right.
I love that. I also love that the truth is, let's call it out, you talk about wanting change, not charity. So it's another, we've got to change the dialogue mindset around a lot of this, because the truth is, as it stands right now, we need money. Organizations, groups, the Mrs. Greens World movement, we need money because people are spending billions of dollars to make changes that I'm not real happy about happen. You see it in elections, the numbers come out. What's happened with the billions that Russia invested in our country to impact the outcome? What can you do, Jacqueline, to get these foundations that have the right mission, they have the right intention, and it's excuse me, without being any disrespect towards foundations that have helped me, it's chump change. We need to put money in the hands of those movements, of those young leaders, because they have to make a living. They have to put food on the table. So how are you being able to liberate some of that capital? Are you having any luck?
Yeah. I mean, we're on it. In fact, I'm proud to say that there are a few foundations in California that are getting it and understanding the sense of urgency that there is right now, right? We cannot be doing business as usual right now. That would be insanity for all of us to just stick on that same path that we have been. In fact, there's been some introspection that philanthropy, by not doing enough around civic engagement and civic mobilizing and just building movements and organizing, one of the reasons why we are where we are right now, because we've been so afraid to just put money out there. We've been so focused on just impact measured by the number of people that are served or the number of programs that are out there, when those things may not be transformation in and of themselves. What about investing in leadership and in organizing? So yes, we are out there boldly sharing this message, working with funders who are getting it and trying to get more of that money into the right organizations. But as you mentioned earlier, we're also just not sitting down telling others what to do. We're trying to also build this movement of Latino philanthropists, right? And when we say Latino philanthropists, we'd like to say civically engaged Latino philanthropists, right? The difference between charity and change is that in the old school way of thinking about it is that we're going to write a check and pat ourselves in the back because we've done something really good. That's charity, like that, and that's welcome, but that's not going to get us to where we need
it
to
isn't.
Go.
It's not going to get us to any finish line right now.
That's right. And so when change requires just that, you know, little bit that you can give, let's give until it hurts, number one, because our country is hurting, so we should be giving until that we're feeling that sense of like, okay, this is more than what I've done in the past. Number two, let's get much more invested in the work than just writing out those checks, right? So when we bring our Latino Giving Circle network together, we say it's about your time, your treasure, and your talents, right? These are folks that are sitting in sectors like the tech sector or in banking or in media or in the arts and entertainment. They have circles of influence that a lot of our nonprofits don't. And how are we using their voices to send this message to their corporations where they work, or the spaces that they take up when it comes to art and entertainment? How are they using their voices to move people in their own spheres of influence to make that change happen, right? Because it's not going to happen just with a couple of people on the margin saying, let's march, let's do this. Yes, that begins a movement, but it really begins to take hold when influential decision makers are part of that process and they're in the front lines along with those nonprofits that are doing the work. So just this past Saturday, we hosted a retreat for 44 of our Giving Circle networks in Los Angeles. And for a full day, one, we did a whole session on racism, classism, ageism, ableism. And so even amongst Latinos, there's a lot of issues that need to be healed and talked about. And then we went further down the path of what does it mean for us to really invest for the long run in Los Angeles and Orange County, in a place where, by the way, Latinos make up 54% of the population, right? And that county is still struggling with poverty, with rates that just don't make any sense. And so what are we doing, not from our own pockets, but to change the institutions and the sectors that we represent to begin to shift the dynamic there and shift the power there and invest in a meaningful way into the organizations and the people that we should be lifting up?
And you have to then highlight again what we have both acknowledged is that this is an education process, a re-education process.
That's right.
It's changing the way we think about things. And
How we think of ourselves in those systems, right? Not as I'm on the receiving end of this. Is that no? We have a voice and we have influence. And how are we using that influence for the better, right? It's so easy to just sit back and say, oh my goodness, this problem is way too big, right? How do I even begin? When we bring the reason the giving circles are important is because it's not just one, it's 44 and it's 87. And it's at the end of the day, our network is made up of 500 members. So when you speak, you feel that sense of power that I'm not alone, right? There are people behind me when I speak this truth, right? In these places of power, and that I have my own power. That's why I don't like the word empowering, by the way, because it assumes that we're giving people back power. People
and
already
you can't.
Have that.
Yes, you can.
And they already have it. All you're doing is giving them the platform and opening up the door for them to just unleash it, right?
But those nuances are important in language, very important that we look at them, because I cannot empower anything or anyone. It's impossible.
And it implies that,
they
need to be given power. People have their own power. It's just we haven't given them the opportunity to just show it and own it and voice it and give them a platform to use it.
So in agreement on that, for sure. Now, let's go a little bit deeper dive into the 2020 census. I, for one, do believe that the census is the cornerstone of American democracy. And when I see some of the blatant forces at work that are trying to destroy that process and skew the results, it shakes me to my core. So what role are you playing, LCF playing, in the Latino community to protect the constitutional right to be counted and represented? What kind of things can be done?
Yeah, and it is going to be a consequential census, in part because we've been leading up to these demographic changes, and so the consequences of them are enormous when you think about the redistricting that will happen after the census, right? So we know that all of the things that are working against the census are not coincidences. They're by design.
Right.
And so for the first part is calling that out. Like, let's not fool ourselves, right? That all of these ideas that are being pushed out there, whether it's a citizenship question or not just ideas, but the lack of planning and lack of infrastructure and the lack of funding from within to prepare for this census is not by chance, right? This is the first time that the census will be on a online platform where people can actually do it on their computers. We know that the digital divide in our country is real, where more than 50% of Latino families don't have access to the internet. They have access to their smartphones but at home, in terms of internet access, the digital divide is there. And it's true for Black communities, and it's true for other immigrant communities as well. And so what we're trying to do is, one, let's call out the issues and let's be upfront about what's happening here. Number two, we're trying this resistance movement to us, and we're going to launch a campaign. You're the first to kind of hear me say it publicly. But this idea of resistance is tied to existence, right? The census matter because it's how you're counted and how you're seen and heard, right? We talk about the vote matters because our voices are heard. Well, the census is how we're seen, right? And so representation and money comes from being counted. And so the resistance movement, to resist, we must exist, right? How, like, the dignity of robbing someone of that, right? Of saying, no, you're not this percentage of this state or this county or this census district, is denying truth, is the fact that, well, we see ourselves every day and therefore we are, but you're just not counting us in a fair and accurate way, and therefore we're not reflected in the numbers. And so this idea, again, of resisting requires us to exist, and the census is about counting that existence at the very core of it. And the other thing that we're doing is working with our nonprofit organizations who do a phenomenal job of registering to vote and mobilizing people to vote. They're the same ones that are going to be out there as messengers to tell our families, hey, the census matters, be ready, fill it up online so you don't have a federal agent knocking on your door, because that can be very threatening at this moment in time, right? There's that part of it. We've been writing op-eds to our local newspapers. I'll send you the last one we just put out in Fresno Bee in the Central Valley, where Latinos are the fastest growing population. To unite people on this, even though it's more than a year away, April 2020, that we need to be getting ourselves mentally, physically ready for this. And then the other part is moving money to organizations that should be the ones out there canvassing, enumerating, making sure people have the information that they need. We want to work with health clinics in California, with libraries in California, with the nonprofits that are big enough to put a kiosk, for example, on site to actually help educate, but then help people fill it out. Because one of the things that we can avoid really is that that knock on the door that people will get once the third or fourth attempt fails in terms of them filling it out. Because in today's environment, it is really risky to open up that door and kind of be vulnerable for some families, right?
And you raised a lot of points in there. Did I interrupt? I didn't mean to.
No. I'll stop there. Go ahead. Ask.
There's so much in this, and it all needs to be talked about, because the question, are you a citizen? And from what I understand, and I tried to check it right up to the minute of this interview, it's still being fought in the courts. There are six states that are lawsuits, and I don't think it has been decided, but it's going to be fought. What are your thoughts on if that question is included in terms of impact? I mean, I'm getting to be somewhat of a conspiracy theorist on some levels. I don't want to be that, but how can this not be considered blatantly, flagrantly racist? What are you doing?
I can't highlight your point enough of it still being fought. And one of the things that I'm really proud of, Gina, that, you know, our advocacy is being felt and heard. So in the judge's decision that he wrote, the 50 or so pages that were issued publicly, and I'll share this with you, I was so proud that Latino Community Foundation was named as one of the organizations. We had sent a letter to Secretary Ross along with 200 other foundations, but he paid attention and his team paid attention to the letter we wrote. I'll send it to you because, you know, sometimes we feel like we fall on deaf ears, but we'll keep at it. But this time it didn't. And organizations and people need to understand that we need to keep our voices loud and articulate about this issue, about that question not being included, because the fight isn't over just yet. But if it does get included, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think it's real. I mean, why else would we want to know, right? There are a lot of reasons why we're giving the PR statements, as I like to say. But at the end of the day, in this climate, let's be real about why that question is being asked now, right? In any other context, maybe less of us would be wondering the intentions behind it. Now, what do we do about it? For certain, we can't discourage people from filling out both the census and the question. It has to be filled out. There's too much writing on it if it doesn't, right? And in fact, I would venture to say, this is where my own conspiracy theory comes in, is that even if it doesn't, the fear that it's kind of put out there has served its purpose. And we have to counter that by the messengers that are being put out there. Because that damage needs to be kept and controlled and fixed. But as far as there are constitutional protection of how the census data is used. Now, what we need to make sure is that the tech companies and others where that information can be easily shared are also aligned with where we need to protect it, right? So those are the types of things that we're beginning to understand and look at, is how much from a legal standpoint can we ensure that that information is not used to harm people's status here in this country or be used to persecute,
no kidding.
For lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I listened to a broadcast on NPR, and a lot of the great legal minds in the country are saying that we don't even have to answer that question, that they legally that is not going to make the census invalid. That being said, to your point about what's at stake if people are afraid, and you had something on your Facebook page that I read about just in the Central Valley alone, this census will dictate funding for 10 years. So just in the Central Valley alone, and underrepresentation by, I forget the number, it was a little number, 200,000 people, will cause $2 billion.
$2 billion with
$2
a B.
$2
billion. Yeah.
So people,
yes,
get out there and help.
Yes, and your, be counted.
Oh,
that's
and
right.
And be counted because...
And for all of our organizations that are out there in Arizona, California, anywhere in the country where you know you have a trusted relationship with our communities, is we have to ensure for them to be counted. We have to ensure for them to be counted because the cost of it is just too... It's 10 years. And here in California, that amounts... So it's $800 billion a year. So when you start multiplying that times 10, like that's a pretty significant number.
That is a big number.
You're talking about clinics, schools, infrastructure, transportation. I mean, these are the things that we all need for our families to be able to thrive. And we will lose that. In fact, California, and that's the Central Valley, but California also risks losing at least 2 seats of representation in D.C. And that can be pretty significant too.
It could be devastating.
So,
it could
yeah.
be that could be
yes.
devastating.
Yeah.
So another question that I don't think you will have any hesitation answering, but if you do, that's fine. Too. But it is my understanding that in order to keep people from knocking at your door, as you said, and be fined or get in trouble, some of the questions that have to be answered are, how many people are living in your household? Do you rent or own your residence? And what is the ethnicity of those living in your home? Are you okay with those questions? And will they help with representing underrepresented populations and they're being counted? I'm
so,
having trouble seeing that,
yeah,
but
no,
maybe
I'm
wrong.
I know. Now, on the number of people who live inside of an apartment or housing unit, this coming from someone where, you know, at one point my parents and I had to live with my aunt and there were 3 cousins.
Right,
and
right,
there's
right.
seasons in our lives where I think we all have to just live that way. And it was for 2 years. But it does matter because it's those numbers that get undercounted. And oftentimes it's poor working class families who can't afford, like Northern California is a perfect example. I mean, the $110,000 is considered working class. Can you imagine that inflated salary? And so to be able to afford a rent of $4,000 and $5,000, you have to live with more than just one other person if you're single or if you're a family, another family involved in that. But those numbers do matter because that's how we actually get an accurate count even for housing. So why are we not planning the right amount of housing for the population that lives here? Well, in part, we haven't gotten the numbers fully right. And that's also in part because people are afraid. And they shouldn't be afraid because no one, number one, can judge you on that. Two, it's an aggregate number, right? So it's not like we're going to find that household and then that many people lived in there. It's an aggregate number that's built on census blocks, right? And so that's really important to understand it. And then as far as race and ethnicity, I think the way I feel about it, Gina, is that we do have to be truthful and honest and bold about putting that on paper.
And it should be something that is celebrated, but we live in an environment where what's going to happen if we tell the truth?
That's true. But what does happen when we don't tell the truth?
Right,
like it's going to come
out. We have to tell the truth.
And the tension that we're feeling as a country that's, by the way, based on lies and misinformation out there is that, well, they're taking the jobs. And they're doing this. No, no. They've always, Latinos have been working and living in this country for, as I said, even before the United States was called the United States. Let's be real about this. And second of all, the jobs that people are talking about are not the ones that most other folks would want because the wages are not what they want. And so let's be counted. Let's be real about where we really are in this country, right? And let's embrace it. It's actually a beautiful thing that this country is made up of so many backgrounds, racial, ethnic backgrounds. And that is a strength of ours that this democracy is still working, number one, and that we are keeping it, like we are trying to make it stronger. And that diversity is really, and I feel like it's sometimes jargony to say it, but it's true. Like what other country do you go to that is not monolithic in terms of the race and ethnicity?
Right, right.
I mean, there are some European countries or some in the Caribbean where there's a diaspora of folks who live there, but not like the United States.
No.
I mean,
no. It is one of the most wonderful things. And thank you so much for clarifying that with such strength and clarity, because you're right. And when you talk about living with your family members, it's one of the most incredibly valuable and impactful components of the Latino community. They take care of each other. Take care of the children. There's so many good things about that. They're not going to turn their back. They're not going to be homeless. You're part of our family, and it's one of the most beautiful cultural additions to our world.
And let's be factual about it, too. In certain circumstances, Gina, it is at a pure need and also how, like, income inequities and affordable housing, like, there's not enough of it available or being built, for that matter.
But at the same time, it's exactly
what you said. And I mean, my family came to this country from the Dominican Republic in the late 60s. They were fleeing one of the worst dictators in the Dominican Republic. And it was Puerto Ricans and Cubans in New York that opened up their doors and said, no, come. There's this apartment available, but you can stay with us until this becomes available. But it's how we do for one another. And isn't that a value that we love, that we're able to, again, lift each other up to a point where we're on our two feet? Like, my parents, then, you know, they worked three jobs, they put their two daughters through college, and here I am running an organization that's really about building a movement about people paying it forward. Like, isn't that what we want for our country?
For everybody.
Isn't that what we're proud of?
Yes.
That's right.
To maximize everybody's potential. Let's go back for a minute to the online presence. To me, there's more and more and more examples of what I call the great divide and the gap widening. When it comes to not just in the Latino community, but for the elderly and low income people who might not have an online presence, they don't have a computer. Do you think that will be a factor that will influence the outcome, and how do we combat that?
Yeah, it's such an important point, in part because, I mean, it's a good thing that we're, you know, modernizing this process, but the bad side of this is that we haven't increased investments to prepare for it, right? So we knew in 2010 that this census was going to be digital, but what didn't happen was that between 2016 and where we are now, there hasn't been enough of a budget built in to prepare our communities and even the local census offices to get ready for that, right? And so they've been on the same budget that they were back in 2012 and 2014 at a moment in time where we're completely modernizing the process and we haven't invested in the infrastructure, right? So there's that higher level piece to this. And then there's the fact that, you know, you look across the country and the folks who've been marginalized, you know, from whether it's an economy or, like I said, the educational gaps, these are the same people that are struggling with having internet access at their home. So how do we resolve it? What we have been thinking about, the Latino Community Foundation, is how do we use hubs in community that already exist, where people already go, like your federally qualified health center, for example, and making kiosks available. And we're trying to raise money right now to make that happen because we think that's critical. The libraries, like, you know, most people don't think that libraries are being used. When you talk to these families that have their kids in school, that's the only option they may have, is to go to a local library so their kids can do their homework. And they, in the Central Valley and even here in San Francisco, they exist and they're great community anchors. And the same is true for the nonprofits that, you know, help people get jobs or, you know, offer tutoring for young people. Those places are where people already congregate in, and we need to figure out how to make it available for them to have a kiosk to fill it out. And the other, like, out of the box idea is that there's a lot of Latino owned small businesses, like local supermarkets. I mean, in New York, the numbers in terms of nail salons and hair salons that are owned by immigrant communities, people frequent them on a weekly basis. Like, why are we not thinking about putting kiosks there, for example, so people can come in, fill out the census, and be done with it?
So another piece of this is you're touching some of the most critical components that will face and form our future. That's how I feel about the work you're doing and how important it is. Where, with all of those competing or vying for attention, important issues, where do you fit in the conversation around climate change? Because if you're in this business like I am, you know climate change impacts low-income, minority, families first and hardest. They're the first hit. They're the hardest hit. Mm-hmm. What is your conversation about that? Because you do care deeply about this issue. So how can you, there's so many competing priorities, which is why you need more money to fund all these great initiatives. But we have to talk about, you know, Latinos are essential in the fight on climate change.
Yeah. I mean, Gina, so we don't see it as a side factor, right? So in fact, I remember at my slide deck, I talked about the fact that all of the movement building that we did last year was done in the context of, you know, two major wildfires that hit immigrant communities here in California. The vineyard workers in wine country, by the way, 77% of them are Latinos. To your point, they're usually either living on the edges of cities that get hardest hit.
Right.
And that's not by coincidence either. Like, we have to be mindful of just in terms of property value and where people are put and how vulnerable they're put. But the truth is that Latinos care about the world that they live in. This connection that we have to the earth goes, you know, back to our native ancestry of, you know, whether it's Mayans or Taínos in the Caribbean. It's ingrained in us at an early age to be connected to the world that we live in and care for it. And we actually did a poll of Latinos leading up to the Gubernatorial forum that we did. And after housing, one of the leading issues that they care about was climate change and the environment. Now, they talk about it differently, right? So climate change, that language may not necessarily be owned by Latinos, but as far as taking care of the earth and protecting families and protecting communities, that's ingrained into who they are, right? And so we need to be able to also widen this conversation to bring in a different way of how we talk about these issues, to bring in the voices of our ancestral influences that we've had in our lives of how the earth is connected to who we are, and lead with that. And as far as it being ingrained into our mission, if you think about what we're doing, Gina, we're trying to build power for the sake of change and social change and justice-driven change, right? Protecting our environment, protecting our earth is really about that. I mean, like, it's using our voice and the power that we have to guard and protect and to love. And that extends into the places that we live, right? So when we think about communities, it's not just the people in those communities, but it's where we live and how we're protecting the places that we live in. And it goes far beyond safety. In the Central Valley, one of the number one issues that Latinos care about is water, because they haven't had access to clean water for decades. If you think about the majority of people and where they live. And for any folks running for office, is being mindful of that. And that's what we're trying to push. So when we say about building political power, we know that that comes with the territory of pushing our politicians and our decision makers to put that front and center, because it matters to our communities.
It's a totally integrated approach, from my opinion. You're looking at it all as there are many needs, and it's not one or the other. We have to look at this as an entire shift in the process. And it's another thing that I have so much admiration and respect. So let's end on an up note, because
and there have been lots of those.
Lots
I have
of
to
those.
Say, you've helped me stay on the positives of where we've come, right, and where we are today. The silver lining in all of this is that people are getting more and more involved, and they're just using their power for good right now.
And one of the things I love, which I said, if you can't measure it, you can't. You can't measure it, you can't improve it.
That's right.
So yeah. I would invite people, and this will all be on our page when the show is released, but latinocf.org is the website. And one of the things, another admirable observation is you're measuring impact. You have a 2017 impact report that people just need to look at to see what can happen. So my last very uplifting question is, Jacqueline, what you're doing is a model. And I don't just say that lightly. We need it all over the country. Are other states watching? Are you able to help other Latino communities by your example and by your impact? What's happening on the national scale?
Yeah, the good news too, Gina, is that thank you. Thank you for that question. And thank you for lifting up Latino Community Foundation to that level. I don't take that for granted. The good news is that there are groups like the Hispanic Federation, for example, in New York, the Latino Community Fund in Colorado, that are doing the same level of advocacy, of movement building. I'm sure you know about the Hispanic Federation because Luis Miranda, who is the founder of that organization, and his son Lin-Manuel Miranda have been very active in Puerto Rico recently, post Hurricane Maria.
Yes.
But they've been around for more than two decades, building that sense of community, of hope, and of power in New York among Latinos there. And it's run by Jose Calderon. And he and I actually, along with Carlos Martinez from Colorado, we're all part of a group called the National Latino Fund Alliance. And what we're trying to do is grow this model in other places where we can generate new revenue to our communities and into our leaders and create platforms for their voices and their concerns to be heard, but more than just need, but to focus on the solutions that they bring to the table, right? So even the climate change piece is, there have been a lot of creative ways where people have attempted to protect from climate change and prevent things from happening. And why are we not putting that on the front end, right? And lifting up our leaders so they can understand that they're not part of the problem, they're part of the solution. And so there's more of that happening. I am hopeful that what we're doing here in California can make its way to Arizona and to Florida and to Texas. We get a lot of phone calls lately from people hearing what we're doing, saying, hey, we want to be able to do this here. And we're more than willing. We need to build our own infrastructure, and we do need those investments so that we are able to kind of look outwardly and see how we can transport this model in different places. And it's really not the model, it's the people, right? When you find a cadre of leaders that can lead, again, from a place of love, not just concern, but of solution-oriented and power building, we can get somewhere really quickly, honestly.
So my final words, I would just like to forward promote our shoot two upcoming shows, which are also amazing. Our local show on February 21st is Kristen Wilt of the TMC Cord Blood Program. Moms, babies, and saving lives. Bring tissues to that podcast because there is a mother and father who will share their story about how a cord blood donation saved the life of their three-year-old daughter at 7 months old, when she was 7 months old. And on February 26th, I can't wait for this one, it's Mika Hollander, co-founder and CEO of Sustain Natural, feminine hygiene products closing the loop. Little do we know how toxic feminine hygiene products are. But these are my, as I call them, deep thoughts from Mrs. Green's world. The Latino Community Foundation is all about building community, connecting leaders, and shaping the narrative. And that is all about creating a socially just and sustainable planet. It is about climate change. It is the important work that needs to be done. We've got 12 years, people. Let's get on with it. And please go visit their website. Let's do it. And I have to say, Jacqueline Martinez Garcelle, thanks for crossing my path. Thanks for Bioneers for having the wisdom to amplify your voice, and Mrs. Green's world will amplify it even more. Thank you,
Gina. My heart is so full right now. Thank you for
so
your leadership,
your
just everything you've poured into this, and how beautifully you've captured who we are. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of this conversation. And I look forward to those other two podcasts. So count on me to be part of the audience for those. Thank you,
Jacqueline,
so much.
You'll love them. I am not
I
kidding.
Think
they
I
were
will.
Very moving, and stuff that people don't want to talk about either. It's just something, there's something everybody can do. So again, thank you and amen, and let's do it. You're right.
Let's
together
do it.
We can. Teamwork makes the
That's
dream
right,
work.
That's right, Gina. That's right.
Thank you.
Sending you a big hug and a kiss. Thank you, Gina.
Right back at you.